We begin the hour by welcoming back our friend writer Colin Fleming, whose latest is called Meatheads Say the Realest Things. It's awesome, and it's available everywhere. Hello, Colin.
Hey, what's going on, Kimball?
I am just back. We had 4 days off. I don't do that well with time off, so I'm glad to be here today.
Oh, belated happy birthday. Feliz cumpleaños.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to chalk up another year. The numbers get higher, but I don't mind. I feel good. I have no complaints.
Are you playing Sergeant Pepper a lot in anticipation of next year, right? When
yeah.
you get older, losing your... You get a nice mane, though. Going
right.
strong.
The hair's still there, but I would take some of McCartney's money. I would feel better about things.
Ah, yeah, you could hook me up. That'd be great. You'd compensate me for my time, Kimball.
I'm happy to do that.
Just, that'd be equitable.
Yes, I would, no question about it. I'd like to be compensated for mine first, but I'll take that up with management. We've got much to talk about this afternoon. First, though, I hope this sees the light of day somewhere, but of all the wonderful things you've written, you know, in the last week, the letter that you wrote to a friend's child, that is just, man, it's beautiful. I don't even know what else to say about it, but it was so good and so profound.
Wait until you read the story I wrote today, which I sent you, which hopefully you haven't gotten to yet. Special one. You'll see it.
All right.
The letter. I put it up on the blog for the two of you out there in Bangor. I can tell. I see your IP addresses. All this time, none of you go to the site. It's disheartening. But I have this friend in the D.C. area, and he has this precocious child who's, I think she's 11. And she has this scoliosis of the spine, and she was misdiagnosed by this doctor from Yale who couldn't even read a chart properly, an x-ray properly. And I saw this email, and it was like Lal and Ritoffel, and it was not surprising to me because most of the people I deal with are trying to deal with her from Yale. And so she's very self-conscious about not wanting to wear this brace that she has to wear like 20 hours a day. And so my friend was having some problems with his dad. He had like this big surgical procedure, all this stuff. So I stepped in, as you know, Campbell, and I stepped in, not really. I sent the child, because smart children like me. I sent her this this letter, and I slapped it up today, too, on the Facebook, because I thought that's really not just for 11-year-old children with back braces and self-doubt and insecurity. It's really kind of some stuff that I think could benefit a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. It was wonderful. Well, let's talk about the first item on the agenda today, which is a great movie from a duo that I don't think gets its due these days for some reason, but Laurel and Hardy, and maybe the best film they made, Sons of the Desert.
From 1933, and I think they fall into the trap that our musical friends, the Grateful Dead, fall into, where you just think it's going to be like slipping on banana peels and very broad comedy, and this is anything but broad. And it's physical comedy, yes, but it's also wordplay-based comedy. It's Joycean comedy in some ways. The whole thing in this film with, you think of the gag, the running rhetorical gag of two peas in a pod, and he's saying two peas in a pot, and so they... Stan gets corrected, two peas in a pod, duh. And then every time the word pod, duh, is said after that, no matter how ridiculous the situation, the D is emphasized. It becomes this very clever verbal leitmotif. And so you have a lot, it's sophisticated comedy, and it's very graspable comedy, and the comedy takes all of these different forms. And this is one of their features, so it's not one of their shorts. And the boys live next to each other. It's very much like the Beatles and Help, right? They all live in the same house. Like the Beatles, Cute and the Monkees, I think, did that too. And so there is this convention. It's based off the Shriners, the Sons of the Desert, and it's out in California. And the leader, like the Grand Poobah, like the Flintstone guy, he's like, come out to Chicago. You have to swear this oath that you'll all come to this crazy convention in Chicago. So then it becomes about trying to dupe the wives and concocting this ruse where Oliver, Tempty one for people who don't know, is going to take this fake trip to Honolulu for his health because his wife doesn't like to sail. And so they get a news report that this liner capsized and all of this stuff. So it's a bunch of hoodwinking and all of that deception that has to fall in the boys' favor for them to get away with this not crime, but this marriage-based faux pas, as it were.
And it operates on so many different levels. Yeah, as you mentioned, there's physical comedy, there's wordplay, and then just those subtle facial reactions that I don't know if anybody's ever been better than Laurel and Hardy at delivering so much with so little.
Ricky Gervais based a lot of his David Brent character off of the facial expressions of Oliver. And Oliver was supposed to be like the dim-witted one. Laurel was the writer. He did all the stuff. But they were great friends. And usually when you have people who are like pretty good friends, it's not like one's smart and one's an idiot. Now, one might be a lot smarter than the other one, but the other one's still going to be like, be able to hold their own, at least in regard to other people. So they were great friends. And I think you see that too. This is like a gentler comedy because Oliver can really bash Stan and some of the other ones. Mm. The whole, that's another fine mess you got us into kind of thing. But they're more palsy in this. And so when they come home from the trip from Chicago, not Honolulu, of course, and it's just hilarious when Hardy has the ukulele and they're outside like the duplex and Stan is, he's actually like pressing the doorbell on the offbeat. So it's like Elvin Jones, like this weird rhythm, and Ollie is singing as he strums Honolulu Baby, Where Do You Get Those Eyes, which is going to come back later at the end of the film. I think the end of this film, the final sequence, when Hardy, in essence, gets busted. Laurel gets busted, but he gets away with it because honesty is the best, as he says, politics.
Politics,
he doesn't even
yes.
know. He's just a dumbass. And then he comes back, and he has one of those bleep-eating grins on his face. And he's smoking, which is a taboo in his house, but he's been rewarded with a cigarette because he's been honest. And he starts singing. When he starts singing Honolulu Baby, because he hasn't sung it before himself, he's just kind of dance, shimmied around. It's not even a dance. It's just like the comedy, it builds to that moment, and it's just, it's priceless comedy. It really doesn't get a lot better than that.
And I love the story that even after Oliver Hardy died, Stan Laurel continued to write routines for the two of them.
Yeah, he didn't want to perform again after Hardy was gone. And Hardy was, if you watch their film near the end, Atoll K, he's lost a lot of weight. He's not, I mean, he was never like this giant, rotund, like fat guy that the way, because they were called like in Mexico, like fat and thin and like gordo and whatever. He was just that. Well, these days, he'd probably be like average, right?
Right.
So that was his persona at the time. And you can see that fraternal nature they have when, like brothers, that they're sparring brothers and they're opposite to attract, but they're both masters of the deadpan. You can see aspects of Bob Newhart in their comedy. And I think it's aged, really, from that era. Charlie Chase is actually in this film, too, so he's another sort of, like, titan at the time. Mm. Buster Keaton and Laurel and Hardy, their comedy has aged, their films, their work, their art, in addition to their entertainment, aged far better than something like The Pictures of Kaplan.
Yeah.
I mean, these, to me, are the Shakespearean clowns. They're every bit as valid as a Shakespeare comedy or some of the funnier bits in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, from a great combo to some other great combos in the world of sports, double play teams. Don't talk about them a lot, but some of the best in baseball are those guys who turn two better than others.
The middle infielders, I was thinking. I was thinking before that maybe this could have been one of our 4th of July things, but just ran out of space. But there's something elegant and obviously efficient about the 6-4-3 or the 4-6-3 double play. And I was thinking about the best combos there have ever been. And of course, you have Tinker to Evers to Chance, the first baseman, which was this poem. And they didn't actually turn that many double plays. Well,
right.
They kind of did relative to the league. But one of the interesting things about that particular duo with Tinker and Evers is that they had a feud and they had a fist fight. And for years, they didn't talk to each other. It's like 14 years after they were done playing ball, when there was like a reunion and they embraced. And so I was just going through some of the combos, like Ozzie Smith and Tommy Herr, Dave Concepcion and Joe Morgan. Oh,
love that one.
Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson. And like, for instance, our Red Sox, I'm not sure they've ever really had a great double play combination. I don't want to say like Rick Burleson and Denny Doyle. I couldn't really think of anyone.
The best one I could find, at least in terms of success at turning the double play, Johnny Pesky and Bobby Doerr.
Yeah, I was thinking of that too. But there's something about the double play that's beyond statistics. It's how it's bad now, right? The eyeball test. There's something about the kind of player I feel you need to be, like the shortstop clearing the runner who slides in, right? Like
right.
Effortless through the air, like hang time. We think of that as like Michael Jordan basketball type of thing, but the hang time of an Alan Trammell and Lou Whitaker.
Oh, yeah. Well, and the way you set your partner up by knowing, okay, the runner's coming in on the right side of the bag, so I'm going to give him that underhand toss to the left side so he can come across the bag and be out of the way before making the throw to first.
And that was like back when, well, there isn't any now, but there was for a while, the whole neighborhood play when no one was near the bag. And also you could clobber the guy. If you watch, there's some funny videos on YouTube of like players don't even bother to slide. It's just like a body block. Like it's Denny Potvin trying to lay somebody out. And actually, in terms of the feed, it's a bit like a one-timer in hockey, like Adam Oates, right? The way he put the puck in a certain spot for Brett Hull to clobber it into the top corner of the net with a slap shot or a half snap type of thing. And you get that, but I think probably, well, they're two of my three favorite players of all time. So I'm going to be biased here, but I think the best double play combo ever would be Nellie Fox and Louis Aparicio of the White Sox, and Aparicio later of the Red Sox. But those were guys who were elite fielders. You look at Aparicio, he's one of the top five like defensive war guys ever. And Fox wasn't far behind. And I think that was like the reason that those White Sox teams, which were actually really good, they just didn't win that much because what were you going to do? You were playing behind the Yankees. Nobody was going to win. But they were kind of like that second or third place team in a wild card era who'd have a World Series or two to their name, largely because of the defense up the middle with those two.
Yeah, and teams built on what I love in baseball, defense, pitching, and speed.
Right, and I was thinking today I was actually just writing this in the blog, I haven't put it up yet, but the Red Sox, because I think the Red Sox this year are doing something quite radical that no one's clocked onto yet. Their run differential so far this year is only plus 64. The barely above 500 Blue Jays are plus 73. The Astros are plus 137, and what that tells me is the Red Sox are winning in a way that no one is really winning in baseball right now, because they're not winning with fielding, and they're not winning with starting pitching, and they're not winning by walking. So it's kind of like a throwback, but with a new technique. They're winning by scrapping, coming from behind more than one time a game often, and bullpen. And no one else is really doing it, living on the edge. And I think that's what some of those older teams like the Go-Go White Sox did. They were living on that edge of speed, defense, intangibles. Clutch play. Now, their clutch play was more based around base running and fielding and that kind of thing, and timely hits, whereas the Red Sox are about scrapping and raking and not really waiting back for the walk and trying to do what they called a couple years ago some damage. But it's an old-school style of baseball, even though it's completely different, which I find so much more baseball-esque. It just has that much more appeal to me than a lot of the other stuff I see.
I love the fact that their biggest stolen base threat on any given night is their catcher.
Yeah, right. It's like in the stolen base, like I get it. Like it's not supposed to be an efficient play. And I was looking at the stats the other day. Do you remember Herb Washington?
Oh, the designated pinch runner. Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at I was wondering what, so we never batted. And he got a World Series ring for 74. I was just like curious what his WAR would be. Like, does he have one? And it was like -0.5. It was like, it wasn't good, but it wasn't like that bad. And I wonder if they, on like the team flight, do they talk to Herb Washington? Like, was he like an equal part of the group? And so, yes. And of course, the most famous play probably in Red Sox history is the stolen base, which is a weird curio. But that doesn't mean the base running's not important. And I see this team, they're aggressive on the bases, which is, I think, what you want to be. You're going to get thrown out sometimes, but over the course of a season, it will pay off more than it doesn't. But they're just good at reading the ball off the bat. And they also seem to play with more alacrity and more enthusiasm for whatever reason for this manager than how they slept walk through last year. But it's successful so far. It's more than half a season, and there is no one else playing their particular brand of baseball. They don't walk, and they commit so many errors, and they're not really a home run team.
All right, another baseball genius, a great that we celebrate. Not everyone appreciates them, but you do, and I do. The man named Kong, Dave Kingman.
So ruthlessly entertaining. Now, I'm going to blow your mind with some numbers, because when I was growing up, and then since, this entire time, my entire life, I was told that Dave Kingman sucks, and it was an embarrassment, and it was a joke, because he'd hit like 210, but he'd lead the league in home runs. Like in 1982, I think he hits 204 for the Mets, and he leads the league with 37 home runs. He's really good, but he's so hated that his last 3 years, he's like kind of a force, especially like his third to last year. But then no one would sign him because he was just such a dick. No one wanted to be around him. He was so into himself, and he was not a good teammate, but he hit the ball like 500 feet. He was just so entertaining, and he didn't strike out as much as people think. And the game is now played the way Dave Kingman played it in 1977.
Right. He was the pioneer of three true outcomes.
He was. And I'm going to blow your mind with this. His OPS plus is the same as your man, Bobby Doerr.
Wow.
Same as Robin Yount. Same as Gary Carter. And you're not going to believe this one. The same as Derek Jeter and better than Ryan Sandberg.
Wow. Wow.
I mean, like, he's supposed to be terrible. And the thing is, he didn't even walk that much. Like, he probably walked an average amount, maybe a little bit more than average for the time. But his slugging percentage for his career wasn't, it was like in the 480s. It wasn't that far below 500, which I consider, have always considered, like you've had an elite slugging year. So that's your career. And he's in the top 10 in home runs, like, I don't know how many times, eight, nine times. 1979, he's a beast. He's just like in the MVP running if he wasn't on such a lousy team and if he wasn't so despised. But he's just like was a fascinating player. You talk about the whole old school, I'd pay to watch that guy hit, or that's not when I'm getting my hot dog or my beer. That's the guy, he's up this inning, we'll sit in our seats, kid, and see this. He'll strike out, fall on his ass, whatever, hit the ball 430 feet. He was that guy. And it's like weird because baseball it's kind of caught up to him in a way. It's like Babe Ruth, too. I wrote a piece on this recently. Babe Ruth was playing the game in 1921 the way hitters try to play the game now, but they don't have his ability, so they're not able to put it together like he did. But the whole get your pitch, take your walk, three true outcomes. But Ruth was more successful with his outcomes because he could still hit for an average. But now average has become irrelevant to the point that you have, like, the Mariners. Were they hitting like 220 something as a team? Kong would lead that team. He'd be their Boggs.
I'm curious, too. I'd love to know what size bat Dave Kingman used, because my recollection is that it always, whatever it was, it always just looked like a toothpick in his hands, and he would just flick those wrists, and the ball would go 480 feet.
It's funny. I was watching that game today, the 1979 Cubs-Phillies game at Chicago with the wind blowing out. So it's like 23-22 is the final score. And Kingman is routinely arguing balls and strikes. Like he's turning around and bickering. He's just fighting with the umpire. But in my mind's eye, of memory, I think of him as like this Paul Bunyan guy. But you see these guys from that time period. Jim Rice is another one who I just remember a certain way, kind of. And he's like this lithe. They're both like whipped thin. They're not thick guys at all. It was like a different body type. And he wasn't this sort of like Michelin man slugger, nor was Rice. Rice looks like he's a shooting guard. He doesn't look like a baseball player as we think of as a baseball player now. So to see that differential with how the modern player, sort of like muscle bound and thick, looks, it's quite a contrast.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. And let's move to a series that we know you love and one that requires me to make a confession, Colin. And it's hard to admit in your presence. I have never seen a complete episode of The Golden Girls.
Is that true? Are you messing with me, man?
No, never.
How's that even? So you just turned a very young 63. And it's on like
you're not a misogynist, are you? You're not like, these Hallmark women, get them out of here, get back in the kitchen, wife of mine, wife of Kimball. Is that what's going on? How could, even by accident, it's like Tom Brady now does commercials for Subways. He's like, I've never been in a Subway. How could you never be in some Subway, like, for some reason, like an emergency? You've never had a Golden Girls emergency?
No, I mean, I've seen snippets, a few minutes here and there, but when the show came out, I was in my 20s. I loved Maude, she was great, and Maude. I love Betty White. Who doesn't love Betty White? But watching a sitcom about older women was not in my wheelhouse at 26, 27.
First of all, this is one of the great, like, sort of fallacies of the Golden Girls. I realize this now. But they weren't that old.
Oh, right? No. I think I'm older probably than Estelle Getty was.
Right. But on the show, it's like, they're golden. It's like, they could actually still be running a marathon. They're not that old. They're like in their 50s.
Right.
So they're really, like, kind of not that much older than, like a Brady, me, in some ways. Oh, it's depressing. But still, yes, well, blame it on your swingers lifestyle and how time-consuming physical love is for you was at the time. But it's...
Wait a second. Have you been reading my diaries? What?
I guess you're more of a Blanche. But look, Kimball, you need to do some soul-searching, and you need to redress and right some wrongs. This sitcom is the best sitcom of the last 40 years. It is so bang on the nose, note perfect, often. So often. And you said, like, who doesn't like Betty White? I'm not inclined to like the characters in shows who are the idiot. I like the Woody or the coach on Cheers. Like, mm-hmm. That's not really my kind of person. They write so well for her that even her dumbassness is witty. And it's a very companionable show. It teaches us a lot about friendship and the raillery of these people, because they are ruthless. I'm watching one the other night, and Blanche and Dorothy they're up late. And Blanche is saying, like, well, what would you say if I died and you were writing my eulogy? And Dorothy's going through it, and Blanche is trying to get more compliments out of her. She's fishing. And Dorothy's like, I'd say you were attractive. Oh, you'd say I was, like, the most attractive, right? And she's going on and on and on. So finally Dorothy says, okay, now you do me. And Blanche says, like, I felt safe around you because you were so big. Like, all these, like, awful things. And so Dorothy gets up to walk away, and she turns to her before she leaves the room. She says, oh, I'd also say you're fat. And I'm like, yes, let's bring back fat shaming. That's some pretty funny stuff. And that is how people, we can pretend otherwise, but that is how people talk with each other, with people that they're actually, like, honest with and friendly with and enjoy a joke with. And, man, Kimball, I have to say, that probably surprises me more than anything.
I know. Carrie is nodding along as you were describing that episode, so clearly he's much more well-acquainted than I am, right?
Yes, I have watched a fair share of, I don't know that I've seen every episode, but I've seen the majority of the episodes of The Golden Girls.
It's on all the time, Kimball. Like, it's just like, oh, yes, I don't, I've never been in the sea. It's like, well, how could you not be in the sea? It, like, at some point, and I'll tell you this is, like, sort of my travel highlight of my career. I don't really believe in travel. But one time when I was a kid, we were at, like, Disney World or the compound or whatever it's called, and I just wandered off somewhere on my own. I was, like, at that age, whatever, like, maybe 13 or something like that. I came to the end. It's not there anymore. I looked it up. Of the Golden Girls driveway. And I sat there, Kimball. I'm like, I'm going to hang. You never know. It could be one of those sort of, like, nexus of the universe things. Like, maybe Blanche will pull up. And I also kind of thought Blanche was hot back in the day.
Well, now, as I was researching, then I'm looking at some of the people who were recurring actors on the show, like Herb Edelman, Monty Markham, Sherry North, Harold Gould, Nancy Walker, Bill Dana. And then I felt even more stupid for having missed out on this cultural experience.
Well, Slater from Saved by the Bell was on it. George Clooney was on it. And I forget who played him, but my favorite, we've talked about him before, my favorite character is Blanche's, well, one of them, was Blanche's hookup partner, Mel Bushman. And he refers to himself in the third person. It's like, you coming over to see the Bushman? How did you get away with this? This is so wrong. It's like, hey, Bushman loves you. It's like, I'm thinking, I feel like on Leave It to Beaver, they're like, hey, Is the beaver pumped? Like, I feel like they knew what they were doing, and they took it, like, as far as they could. Like, hey, Bushman loves you, baby. I'm like, yeah, get her, Bushman.
Yeah, the writers absolutely knew that they were able to get away with things coming out of the mouths of three, four older women than they would have if it was a 20-something cast.
And Kimball, I told you, the best joke in the history of sitcoms is when, this is probably like 2 years ago, we talked about when Rose was talking about how her husband, one of her husbands, Charlie, died. And she said, we were being intimate. That's why I don't want to be intimate with any guys right now. And Blanche's like, how did you know? And because Rose says, at the end, he started yelling out, Rose, I'm going, I'm going. That is like such an extra, like, I can say that, but it feels like I shouldn't even be able to get away with that right now. I guess it probably went over like some people's heads, like at the time, maybe. Today, sadly, even more so.
I will write that wrong.
Really well written.
I will get to it now, Colin. Again, it's a world that I'm ashamed to admit I don't know, other than clips and highlights. But I will make that deep dive this summer.
Maybe if you weren't listening to Christopher Cross and reflecting back on your swinger days with Glee so often, you'd have a little time to power through some Hallmark. Joy and Bonanza. It's great.
Yeah, those times may have gone hand in hand. Finally, we talk about something we can definitely agree on, the wonder of the magic that is yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Another great five-part, 15-minute-a-piece episode, The Midas Touch Matter. Man, I love this one, too. Great characters, great story, looking at an abandoned gold mine. And anytime you've got a character whose very name is Hard Luck Dennis, you know it's going to be fun.
Yes, and it actually takes place, coincidentally, in Kingman, Arizona.
Yes.
So, the Shadow of Kong looms large today. And I picked this one because it went out over the airways, I think it wrapped up 65 years ago today. Wow. A Friday, obviously, back in 1956. And I feel like it's a very average five-parter, which is to say, it's really good.
Mm.
It's not as good as some of the ones we've talked about, but it shows like how even when this show, with that five-part format, was sort of like middle grade, it was still better than just about anything you're going to get. And Johnny Dollar is summoned to, takes a circuitous route to Kingman, Arizona via Las Vegas, and he gambles and puts all that money on his notorious expense account. And, yeah, it's very much like a Hardy Boys type of mystery, three investigators, about a salted mine and a cave-in and some brothers who died in it. And he meets this cop. And it's worth noting, too, for everyone's like, oh, cops are so bad and all of that stuff, although it's probably not this audience. But Johnny Dollar himself was a cop at one point. He was a Marine. That's like all in his backstory. I don't think that's referenced in any of the episodes that you might have heard yet. And so he usually befriends cops, and they're like good people. So he befriends this one cop named Buster in this particular episode. And Buster's going to come back a year later in July 57 in one of the half-hour episodes, the Yours Truly Matter, when Johnny Dollar takes a buddy road trip with him. But I think that scene when they're in the mine and Buster grabs the rattlesnake by the tail.
That the best part of the whole episode is what he does with the snake.
Yeah, you're not ready for this to happen, and you're not ready for the sound effect.
Yeah.
And then you're not ready for the addendum when he's like, you do it just right, you can snap the head right off. Like, you get the willies listening to it, and then you get the willies further because Johnny Dollar's like, okay. He's clearly, like, disturbed. He's seen this, too, and he's almost, like, caught the cave-in himself when he's trying to get, like, a nugget for a souvenir.
Mm.
And you have a strange amount of water in this gulchy kind of episode. A lot happens on boats, so you wouldn't really think that, but you can lure, sort of a pun, Johnny Dollar somewhere because he's, like, he loves fishing so much. That's a way to get him to take any job with his copy of The Complete Angler in his duffel bag, probably. And so there's a lot of, like, good talk about Lunker Bass, big, fat bass. And, like, but it puts you right in the picture, doesn't it? All those episodes.
And always with great character actors, and I'm pretty sure that it was Parley Bear, who has been in other episodes, who played Jake Kessler in this one.
Yes, he's Parley Bear. He's a regular in these. So is, what's his name? Speaking of the Flintstones. Fred Flintstone.
Melvin.
He's in a bunch of them. He's in a bunch of them too. And then just like the writing, it's very indelible. Like you said, there's a character. He has kind of an unfortunate end called Hard Luck Dennis, which is like, it sounds in a way like someone else would have thought of that as like a typical name for a prospector who's never really struck it big. Like that guy in the Brady Bunch episode is like, are you my claim, you stupid kids, like that kind of thing. He's a Hard Luck Dennis kind of guy. And then at the end, when you find out who, like, well, kind of a few different bad people, but when there's a female bad person at the end and Dollar's on the phone, this is the great line he has. And he's sort of talking to this insurance agent who might be able to come rescue them. She's like, hang up the phone. And you're trying to give away like your location. Like he throws the receiver at her and goes, hang it up yourself. It's like so dismissive and caustic and badass that it's like, yeah, it's like one of those sort of like Robert Mitchum in Out of the Past when he tricks them with the phone book and the guy goes to slap him in the face and Mitchum stops him with his hand and like clocks him. It's sort of like that, but the radio version.
And the little aside when Dennis gets hurt and eventually expires, but before that happens, and one of them says, guess he earned that nickname.
Yeah, he did. And it reminds me of that, and it was the next week that it aired too, the Shady Lane matter.
He's
talking to the constable up in Vermont, and the constable's niece has, of course, been shot and sitting in just her living room. And Dollar says to him, like, well, what kind of person was she? And the constable says, I guess it was, what was her nature? He asked her. He says, it was her nature, I guess. It's so sad, so forlorn to be a victim. Mm. And it's like a slightly more upbeat. I mean, you still get somebody expiring, but it's a slightly more upbeat version of that notion, of that line, that theme. And so I think the one, the Shady Lane matter, is so good. I'm not even exaggerating. I listen to that at least once a day. It's just that much of a formative kind of piece of hearable art to me. As much so as a Dylan record or whatever. It's just every single day I listen to that, I think it's just one of the best works of art I've ever heard. Whereas this one that we're talking about today was just high grade entertainment. Mm.
Colin Fleming. Check out his website, colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. Get your hands on a copy of Colin's newest book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things. Me, I'm off to catch up on the Golden Girls, and we'll talk with you next week, sir.
Yeah, I'm going to be working some more of that into the rotation so that you're not deceiving me. I don't want to have to lose respect for you, man. I don't have a lot of respect for people, and I feel like you've gone from a solid 8.3 down to like a 7.2 today, so we'll have to work on that.
I'm going to be the comeback kid. I'll bring it back for you.
All right, man.
See you, Colin. Colin Fleming, every week on Downtown.